This is Rabbi Josh Uter, and welcome back to the Utopia Podcast. Today I'll be schmoozing with my very special guest, Rabbi Avram Bronstein, and we'll be sharing some of our favorite articles from the newly opened Archives of Tradition. So a few weeks ago, the Rabbinical Council of America released to the public the archives in PDF format of its journal Tradition, a journal of Jewish thought. This was really, for me, something very exciting. Tradition was something which I had read periodically, most because, you know, I would find it in my father's mail and say, hey, this looks interesting, and pick something up. And over the years, there have been some incredibly important articles published in this journal Tradition, and it gives a bit of a window into, I think, what modern Orthodox Judaism used to be, and how discourse used to happen, how people would address certain topics, and even what topics were addressed, and also who was considered part of the conversation. Just to give a quick example of the very first edition published in fall 1958, it had articles by Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, who I speak about with Rabbi Bronstein later, on arrogance or humility in prayer. Professor Lewis Feldman has an article on philo-Semitism among ancient intellectuals. And you have Lord Emanuel Jacobowitz writing of the dissection of the dead in Jewish law, a comparative and historical study. And it evolved over time, based on interests, based on what was relevant. I think also just as a means of introduction, Rabbi Solomon Sharfman at the very beginning, and in his preface says, the world in which we live no longer permits us to reply to every doubt. This is the law, or the Torah says so. Indeed, very seldom in Jewish history were such answers sufficient, nor were they considered desirable in a faith where proper answers always depend on the right questions, and where even Moses, as depicted, as constantly seeking but never obtaining the complete understanding. Rabbi Lam, in the same introductory volume, writes, by tradition we mean neither a slavish adherence to old formulas nor a romantic veneration of, quote, the good old days, which strips the past of all meaningfulness for the present. In our conception of tradition, we do not consecrate exclusively on the past at all. The word itself comes from the Latin tadere, I apologize if I'm butchering my Latin, it's not that great, which means to hand down, to transmit, to bequeath. Similarly, its Hebrew equivalent masorah derives from the root masar mem samech resh, which means to give over. The focus of tradition is, then, the future and not the past. Tradition is thus a commitment by the past to the future, the promise of roots, the precondition of a healthy continuity, that which is worthy of being preserved, the affirmation that the human predicament in general, and the Jewish situation in particular, are not frighteningly new, but that they grow out of a soil which we can know and analyze and use to great benefit. The very fact that such words were written in a modern Orthodox journal is really spectacular, especially in retrospect, and given how Orthodox Judaism speaks about Judaism today. And tradition was a place where such arguments were, in fact, normal, in describing matters of halacha, matters of theology. And what I decided to do was, instead of just me giving my own top list, called upon a friend of mine, Rabbi Avram Bronstein. We did a Skype interview. You'll apologize, at some point in the middle, it kind of, we got hung up on and it got really fuzzy. So I apologize for the technical glitch in the middle. And we both went through just titles or things that we happen to have read that made a big impact on us, aside from certain obvious ones, like Rupture and Reconstruction by Professor Chaim Soloveitchik is, you know, one of the classic pieces that have come out of there. And we try to find things that were a little less obvious for people to I think, really appreciate what tradition was about, not just in terms of the journal tradition, but also in a way, what was the tradition of discourse in terms of what was said, how it was said, and who participated, which today is very different. We speak about that a bit too. Also, this was the first time I did a joint podcast, so the audio is in stereo. So please bear with me with that. My audio engineering skills are not that spectacular, and I don't have the time right now to worry about fading in and out. So be warned, you'll hear one of us coming out of one speaker and the other coming out of the other. But this was, for me personally, a really, really fun conversation. And all the links that we talk about are in the blog post. You can read these articles directly. And I'd also suggest that, you know, take a look through the archives. There's an Excel spreadsheet with everything that's there. And just pick something up and do some reading. And, you know, increase some of your knowledge. Get some extra footnotes for something that you're interested in. And get to see a part of what Orthodox Jewish intellectual history was like. Even if it's a small snippet, it's something which I personally find very fascinating. So without further ado, here is my recent conversation, Schmooze, with Rabbi Avram Bronstein. And I'd like to welcome an old friend of mine, Rabbi Avram Bronstein, currently the director of programming at the Great Neck Synagogue. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
Excellent. You might know him. He was also the assistant rabbi at the Hampton Synagogue. And if you got a really good memory, it was one of the elders of the Protocols blog, probably one of the first, if not the first, major Jewish blog. So a bit of history here, too. So, Avram, you went to YU. We're somewhat contemporary. So we actually, you know, have a little bit more exposure to tradition, I suppose. By tradition, of course, again, here and all out, capital T, referring to the journal, not tradition in terms of, you know, Masorah. So did you have, like, classes that reference tradition articles a lot?
I don't really recall them ever really doing that. My sense is that tradition sort of fell between a few different areas. For the more scholarly academic classes or citations, tradition was never really a place where you found academic articles or articles that worked in the scholarly world. For things that were more in terms of classical lundus or learning, then you had other journals for that. Tradition sort of fell between those larger extremes. It was more for think pieces. It was sort of the long form magazine thing. It was for, you know, random works of scholarship that didn't necessarily fit into any category other than more general Orthodox thought. So it was something that you read. It was something that you certainly skimmed the table of contents of, but it didn't really fit into any particular things that were actually happening at YU, I think. That's my recollection anyway.
I think that is a fantastic summary of the journal as a whole. But the reason why I mention that is, and I would know about tradition because my father would get, you know, subscriptions to it. In fact, he used to have a column, Current Jewish Periodicals, and I think he wrote a couple of things for it. None of those made my list, mind you. I figured keep it as unbiased as I can. And every now and again, though, I did find that some classes would, in fact, you know, cite tradition, or at least one article or two, but that could have been a function more of the class of this year. So anyway, we both have our list of, you know, five articles, not so much that these represent the best tradition has to offer, but five things that somehow stuck out for any, you know, either one of us for, you know, either who wrote it or for what it says or implications or just something interesting about it. So go ahead, take the first one.
Okay, so the first one that I picked comes from Volume 2, Issue 2. So that comes from spring of 1960 or 1959.
Oh, I like that. Going old school right off the bat.
There was a little bit of confusion. I have these listed in chronological order.
Sure.
And it was an article, it's a book review, which was written by Victor B. Geller. Which goes back to the very old school YU. It stuck in my mind. Victor Geller at the time was the field director of Yeshiva University's Community Service Division, which is maybe the ideological great-grandfather of the Center for the Jewish Future.
Wow.
Right. You know, that became the Department of Communal Services. and that became something else. And then I think eventually that sort of, it was resurrected as the CJF. So Victor Geller was responsible at the very, very earliest level, going back to Dr. Belkin, as president of YU, in terms of YU reaching out to communities, in terms of trying to use YU as a resource for Jewish communities, for sending rabbis around the country. And he was really one of the architects of American Jewish life in that generation. Rabbi Riskin, for example, I'm sitting here in the Or Torah Stone office. Mm. Rabbi Riskin counts him as an early mentor, one of the people that was immensely helpful to him, you know, convincing him to go into communal service, being a resource to him in Lincoln Square, etc. And the review is entitled "How Jewish Is Jewish Suburbia?" Mm-hmm. Right. So imagine he's writing this in 1960 as Orthodox Jews are first moving out of the cities into the suburbs. And the book that he's reviewing is called "The Jews in Suburbia." It's a more of a sociological book written by a Rabbi Albert Gordon. It was apparently even serialized in the New York Post in November and December 1959. And the book is very enthusiastic about Jewish suburbia. Gordon writes, quote, "The Jews of suburbia have to date achieved a high degree of integration into the total life of their communities. They've also succeeded in attaining a high measure of identification with the Jewish people and its way of life. Weaknesses, imperfections, and even decay and dissolution are readily apparent to the observer in the Jewish way of life, to be sure." Right? He's already noting the beginning of assimilation, the beginning of the drifting away that became much more pronounced over time. But he says, however, as has been noted throughout the study, there is much about which we may be highly pleased. There are more Jews, enthusiastic Jews, and there's a lot of hope concerning the future. Geller himself is a little bit less enthusiastic about it. And he makes a few very interesting points that I think looking back over, let's say, 50 or 60 years of Jews in suburbia, I think strike us, very, very, strike us almost prophetically.
Yeah.
Because, for example,
you hit on just such a great point that I noticed when I was going through these articles. You have a lot of prognostication of people trying to predict, you know, here's where the Jewish community is, where's it going to be in 20, 30 years, you know, trying to predict in the long term. And now you can actually see how many of these predictions came true. You can see, well, here's what people thought of back then. Were they right? You know, where were they right? Where were they wrong? And maybe why? You know, because you could wind up with a right answer for a completely different reason, especially when there's so many variables in play. So that is a great, great first start right there. And I honestly had no idea who this person was. I came across that article, but I was like, all right, fine, whatever. But thank you for sharing that. I had no idea who that individual was.
Absolutely. It's interesting. He goes across it. He points out, this is already in 1960, that one of the consequences of suburbia is, a much more loose family structure where things are in different directions. You notice that already parents are waking up earlier to get to work than they ever did. He's noticing, and this is very interesting, I guess, going back to 1960, speaking about the mother's role. He writes, "Mother is best characterized as the executive director of the suburban Jewish family, early rising, hardworking homemaker, chauffeur, social secretary, ambassadress to the community, tone setter for her family." And then he says, "Among her most prized possessions is something she never had in the urban area from which she came, a driver's license."
Hmm.
He's noting that this makes her life radically different from the life of her counterpart in the city, because she's free to move about. She's free to have her own life. She's involved in PTA, sisterhood, tadasas, all these different things. He said, you know, while on one hand it's amazing, there's this incredible freedom that women have in suburbia that they don't necessarily have in more urban environments, he's worried about the family structure, especially in a situation where the father, again, this is going back to when there was one wage earner, is in leaving early in the morning to commute and is getting home, you know, after 8 o'clock at night.
Wow. And you're saying this is from 1960.
This is 1960.
Wow.
So he says a few interesting things. He talks about how one of the things that happens, he talks about different concerns that raise, and they're very similar to concerns nowadays. He also talks about one of the things that happens in suburbia is this sort of over-focus by parents on kids. Everything is supposed to be child-centric, that the reason why you're moving out to suburbia in the first place is to indulge your children, to give them all these different experiences, to sort of build life around them. He writes, much is made both in the book Under Discussion and in other recent literature about the beauty of rituals and ceremonials and of their value in bringing Jewish culture to our children. He says, my experience tells me, however, that the young, uninformed, and non-observant Jewish family derives very little from these rituals, which struck me as very interesting, especially this is the very beginning of the Kiruv movement, 1960. He writes, aesthetically, the beauty of Kiddush, Havdalah, the Motzi, etc. has been vastly overrated. There is little drama in these practices. I cannot understand how rabbis and Jewish educators have been able to convince themselves that a paragraph in a foreign language chanted by an old man with questionable vocal or musical ability over a cup of wine constitutes in and of itself a religious experience. To a youngster whose day-to-day life has little Jewish practice, Kiddush is not necessarily beautiful at all. Up to a certain age, it can have a hocus-pocus effect because it is strange or mysterious. For the teenager, neither Kiddush nor any other such practice can be important if his father, who is his primary guide in life, does not demonstrate genuine acceptance of it. And he says part of the what he's noticing is that parents are sort of play-acting these Jewish rituals for their children. He says the transformation of Kiddush into a child-focused symbol is basically a performance or a show. It's an admission that the child is outside the realm of Jewish experience, that he's merely a visitor to Judaism. So it's a very interesting sort of take. You know, on one hand, we sort of build up suburbia or the suburban lifestyle as, you know, building up these experiences for children and showing children what to do and constructing these special environments for children. What he's saying is that to a certain degree, kids are very good at knowing when they're being pandered to. Generally, those are the first things that they ditch on the way out.
Right.
Which is very interesting, that I thought was a very interesting observation.
Sure. You know, kids do pick up on the dissonance, and it's you know, that's something which I know people have spoken about for decades afterwards. So, wow, that's a pretty great prediction there.
So it's a good prediction. And finally, the last major point he makes is in terms of continuity of generations. He notes that in urban areas, one of the advantages is that you have different generations that live in very close proximity, whereas in suburbia, people tend to segregate based on age group, and especially the way that he saw the communities breaking up in the early 1960s, the younger families lived in suburbia, the older families, the grandparents, the great-grandparents stayed back in the cities, and there was a very large gap between them geographically, but also just in terms of contact. You know, the grandkids never really saw the grandparents that much. They didn't have as much exposure to them. And that was something that worried him a great deal. So that was the article. He writes in the end that, you know, the truth is that we know that there is, you know, there is hope for Jewish suburbia. He says the Jewish tradition has been faced with harder tests in the past. It's hard to believe that suburbia will undo Judaism. He says Torah can be made to flourish in the neat little ranch houses of suburbia, just as it once did in the steaming tenements of the metropolis. Mm. And I guess maybe to a certain degree he's correct.
But even the rhetoric is a great line. I mean, today, you know, if you're going to write something like, you're going to have like all the doomsayers, like, yeah, this is terrible, this is the destruction of Judaism. And even as it just shows just how the rhetoric has changed, this seems to be a measured criticism, acknowledging it's like, yeah, these are things we got to work out for, but my God, you can't say, like, we haven't had it worse. Like, if the worst thing we have is, you know, a split level out, you know, with a sidewalk, you know, unless you, like, think back to Ha'azinu of Yishman Yushurun Va'ivat, but whatever, you know, it's just different. Thank you. That was a great one. I think I'll keep your pattern here of going chronologically. Unfortunately, and if you search the archives, you're going to find not every article that you'll find like listed or cited in Rambi is actually going to be in tradition in the archives. The archives do have a search engine that I'd give it maybe a C, if that. You're usually much better off if you go through the archive menu and select the exact volume number and the date than if you try to do a full text search on it. This is a quote. This is from the next two I'll do are actually from Rabbi Lamb. The one that isn't there, actually referenced in my article, in my shiur on Aguna. This was from Tradition 2-1, so the one right before the one you just cited, from 1959. It's called Recent Additions to the Ketubah, a Halachic Critique. And in the article, Rabbi Lam basically gives his rejection of the Lieberman Clause. And for me, what sticks out about this is something that I was mechaving to years later, and I really wish I knew about this then, because I would have cited it, is how he goes about giving his own rebuttal. He writes, "The leaders of Orthodoxy in America have stated unequivocally that the amendment is not halachically valid. Unfortunately, no detailed refutation by a competent scholar has been published to date. This essay, without laying claim to scholarly thoroughness, is an attempt to make good, in an elementary and popular matter, a debt that the Orthodox rabbinate owes to the American Jewish public." Meaning, even during the height of Orthodox and conservative fighting, Rabbi Lam realizes here, you can't just say it's bad because it's conservative. You actually need to give an answer. And he phrases it as a debt that the rabbinate owes the Jewish public. If you think they're wrong, don't just say, well, you're wrong, blah, blah, blah. You actually have to give an argument. Now, whether or not you agree with Rabbi Lam, the details get very complicated with a smachta, but I'm not going to even explain that here. Go listen to that shiur. But even if you disagree with his assumptions, you disagree with the very fact that he says, we have a disagreement, this is serious enough, and we as leaders owe it to the community to explain our reasons, is something which is unfortunately rare today in terms of how halachic rhetoric goes. But unfortunately, you can't find that article in the archive as of yet. Hopefully they fix it. The next one is, but this is also a mistake that they have. This is from also Rabbi Norman Lam, Tradition 7-8, 1965 to 1966. The actual title is, quote, "The Religious Implications of Extraterrestrial Life." If you search it in the archives, it's "The Religious Implications of Terrestrial Life," in which case, I mean, you think about a typo, but like the religious implications of terrestrial life, you're like, yeah, you know, that doesn't really help. And what just struck me about this is that, especially, you know, for the beginnings of tradition, it's almost like this, I use the term think piece, it's almost like this philosophical think piece, which today you might consider as somewhat indulgent. But Rabbi Lam actually gives it a solid theological treatment. Like, how would this affect our faith? Yeah.
I'm sorry, not to cut you off. I'm just thinking that as I was going through all the tables of contents, and there's a spreadsheet on the website that has the entire list going back to the very beginning, which is, you know, just a wonderful resource just to, you know, sort of skim through and see who is writing what and when. There's a few articles that are about, you know, keeping Shabbat in space, or the halachic implications of space travel, or, you know, keeping halacha on the moon or whatever it was.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to imagine, you know, now, but if you think about maybe the 60s and the 70s when the space project was really in people's consciousness, these were sort of, you know, theoretical questions people were trying to answer, maybe even in a, you know, more speculative, this could really be a, you know, honest in 20 years kind of way.
Or it could have just as
a very Jetson sort of perspective.
Or it could have easily been like one of the earlier attempts at like pop psychology or pop halacha, where you say, well, you know, this stuff, you know, yeah, it's on one hand, you can take it, the topic, seriously and teach real halacha by virtue of something. Like, if you just get up and give a shiur on theology, right, you're going to tune people out. When you think of it in terms of, you know, something that might be more colloquial, like, hey, are there aliens, right, then reading an article is like, wait, I never thought of that. So sometimes it's kind of like a backdoor to get to something more substantive. Anyway, what's your second one?
My second one, I have a list of six or seven here, so I'm just
go
thinking
ahead.
Based on
chronology.
Okay. My second one is from, hang on a second, let me just get the citation. It's from volume 8, issue 4, 1966, by Michael Weishgrad, and it is entitled "The Jewish Interest in Vietnam." This was published in 1966. And by then, of course, the debate over the American involvement in Vietnam, the beginning of the war, was already upon us. And I guess the way that he describes it is that it's very easy to sort of see how the liberal reform Democrats, the way that he puts it, the liberal wing of the American Jewish community was very much against the war because they were mostly against wars in general. They were very pacifist, as they mostly still are now. And he tries to argue. He's a professor of philosophy. He, I think, was born in Vienna, actually. He, at the time, was teaching philosophy at City College in New York, at CUNY. And he argues that there was an innate Jewish interest in whether to escalate American involvement in Vietnam or not. He says it's an interesting idea. He says one of the critiques that he has for the American Jewish community in general is the fact that they're trying to argue for larger values as opposed to communal self-interest. So he says, he talks about the ADL, the American Jewish Congress, of blessed memory, American Jewish Committee. He says they suffer from a certain ambivalence. In most cases, these organizations base their defense of Jewish rights on appeals to general humanitarian and liberal principles, which they argue are threatened wherever Jewish rights are curtailed. But he says that's a fallacy. His argument is that you can't have any defensible notion of justice. You can't say anything is right unless there's also a legitimate self-interest. And he argues that there is a Jewish self-interest in Vietnam. And he makes a few interesting cases for it. So I thought this was interesting on a few levels. The arguments themselves, you can take them or leave them. He argues that communism in general has proven itself to be bad for Jewish communities, right? Obviously, with the Soviet Union as the prime example. He debates whether that's true or not. He wonders whether the North Vietnamese liberation movement would embolden Palestinian terrorists, who at the time were mostly defined as a secular communist organization. The PLO was a secular organization. And he quotes a chairman of the PLO, an Ahmed Shugari. I'm not sure what his relationship was with Yasser Arafat at the time. This is November 1966, who was quoted in the Times as saying that the PLO was watching the Viet Cong very carefully. And they're taking lessons from them, and they're thinking about whether anything they're doing would also be have implications for their own struggle. So he says that if America proves not to be reliable in terms of South Vietnam and negotiates a settlement or pulls out or otherwise allows the North Vietnamese liberation movement to win, that could only endanger Jewish lives in Israel. And he argues, therefore, the Jewish community has the right to support the Vietnam War from a perspective of Jewish self-interest. And he makes a few other arguments like this. But what's interesting is that his larger critique, and I thought this was interesting mostly, is that he critiques the American Jewish community for not responding to threats based on American Jewish self-interest or larger Jewish self-interest, and instead of arguing only in terms of these larger liberal values. He says that you can get to the right answer, and the Jewish community has to have this sense of pride, a sense of integrity in terms of standing up for itself, which also was very striking in the context of coming to a political discussion that had much wider implications.
Yeah, especially since the logic is very tenuous. I mean, there are a lot of ifs there. You know, the fact that they're watching it closely, I mean, it's like, well, sure. I mean, given all the moral implications involved, to say, well, this is good for the Jews because somehow it helps Israel. Also, if you read that today, it's like, wow, it really is the Israel lobby that determines all of our policies. You know, but...
Right, exactly. Meaning now, especially, people are very careful to say that America, let's say Israeli interests and American interests are aligned with it's good for America. You know, let's say the Iranians can't have a nuclear program, not because Israel doesn't want them to, but because ultimately it's not good for America.
Right.
Here, what he's saying very clearly is that we're trying to influence American policy because, you know, like every other group, we have the right to stand up for our own self-interest, however you play that out today.
Right. And as we both know, people vote for policies for even dumber reasons.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, well, thank you. That was also a great one. Throwing in, like, history and politics, too, because, I mean, I wasn't alive in the 60s, but the Vietnam War was a highly contentious issue. I'm not sure if, like, it really gets conveyed today, given the way that we talk, but it really, really was a huge deal.
I think I could be wrong, but on a quick view, I think this was the only article ever published in Tradition having to do with the Vietnam War. And I'm not even, which is interesting, I'm not sure if there were any articles, let's say, that were published about the recent Iraq-Iran war. There must have been a few in terms of ethics of war and in terms of, you know, rules of war and those kinds of things. But I'm not sure if there was any article that would, you know, take up, let's say, should America get involved in Iraq or Afghanistan, or should America fight an international war on terrorism from a Jewish perspective. Those aren't the sorts of articles that we see anymore, I don't think.
Well, you see them just not in tradition anymore. I mean, back then, I don't know how much, you know, I don't know what the publishing world was then, but, you know, this was certainly years before blogs. Right. So today, like, you know, do we have a Jewish opinion? You know, what's the Jewish rule about, you know, how do we attack ISIS? You could find, you know, a Google search 5 minutes, you know, five articles on that. You know, here, this was at least a forum at a time where it could be, you know, discussed. And I mean, granted, the caliber certainly back in the old days was much higher than what you find on the internet today. But yeah, you
know. I think that's what I'm saying more, meaning, you know, this is it's a 17-page single-spaced article, basically arguing for the American Jewish community's ability to advocate for its interests and what its interests should be.
Right.
You don't really get a sense of that on blogs nowadays.
No.
And I don't think that and it's interesting. I'm not even sure if the Jewish community, you know, in terms of the organs that people read, certainly not for rabbis. Certainly not in the classes of people that would be reading a journal like Tradition. If there's really an outlet that would give you a space for an article like this, or if it would even occur to anybody to write one.
Maybe Hakira. But I think something more important, and this goes back to how the web has changed just any of our dialogue, because there weren't so many publications, people were reading the same thing. And if people were reading the same thing, your audience is going to be a lot more diverse. It might not be bigger than you have on the web, where, you know, a few thousand people can see it instantly. But when you have to write to both people to the left of you and people to the right of you at the same time, you're going to have to write a lot more carefully in order to try to convince them. If I write on a blog where I know I'm going to one certain segment of a community, right? It could be just five people I know. I can write very differently because I don't care about everybody else. They're not even on my radar. When you would publish in something that goes out, I mean, the Tradition was the Journal of the Rabbinical Council of America. So you're going to, like, all pulpit rabbis all across the country, and, you know, some that aren't even rabbis, and you gotta write a lot more carefully when you're trying to convince people who are, you know, thinking differently than you. My next one fast forwards a bunch of years. And it goes to spring summer of 1964 from Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, otherwise known as the Rav, Confrontation and Addendum. Now, I actually gave a class on this too a while back on interfaith interactions. For me, the actual article Confrontation isn't nearly as interesting as the addendum that came afterwards. It says here that it was published in a Treasury of Tradition in 1967. You can find it on the website, though, again, from Volume 6, Number 2, Spring, Summer of 1964. And for me, what I found so fascinating about this is the actual Confrontation reads like a lot of things that Rav Soloveitchik does. It's very philosophical, very technical, goes off in lots of different directions, can be hard to follow sometimes, and, like, unfortunately, many things Rav Soloveitchik does is subject to being recreated in the reader's own image of what did he really mean. After that was published, he wrote the addendum, where he actually is incredibly straightforward. To summarize what he says here, actually, I'll just quote because I have it in front of me. We are therefore opposed to any public debate, dialogue, or symposium concerning the doctrinal, dogmatic, or ritual aspects of our faith, vis-a-vis similar aspects of another faith community. But he does say that, and he goes into it, deemed improper to talk about Jewish monotheism and stuff like that. But he says, when, however, we move from the private world of faith to the public world of humanitarian and cultural endeavors, communication amongst the various faith communities is desirable and even essential. Now, what I find really remarkable about this piece here isn't so much, you know, whether or not you agree with the statement, but that he has to write another article, an addendum that says explicitly, like, prescriptively, here's what I think is good, here's what I think is bad. Because if you just rely on what he wrote in Confrontation, you can come up with so many different things and your head can get lost in the clouds. So for me, I think this is just wonderful because for everyone who likes quoting Rav Soloveitchik, you actually him seeing being very explicit in his own words. And the fact that, again, that he did it as a follow-up to something that was, you know, more in the theological or philosophical realm, I would actually be interested to know, even when he was alive, how were people quoting him when he still had the capability to write an addendum saying, this is what I'm, like, practically, here's what I'm talking about. He doesn't actually say here that he was being misquoted. What? Yeah, you know, I see.
Right, this is what I
meant. This is what I actually meant. I mean, he doesn't say that explicitly, like, by the way, people have been misquoting me, and here's what I meant. That does happen, by the way. You know, comes up at least once in Rav Moshe Feinstein, where I saw he went to town on someone who passed around a pamphlet saying, this Eruv is kosher according to Rav Moshe. And people do this when rabbis are still alive, of here's what he said, here's what he meant. Kal v'chomer, after they pass away, like, you know, you could say, well, here's what he truly meant, you know, without them getting. And so for me, you know, when Rav Soloveitchik can give you an actual explicit contribution where it's just so straightforward of this is his opinion, is, I think, incredibly useful and fascinating, again, that he felt the need to do so. All right, what do you got next?
Absolutely. I'm saying it's also interesting just in that context that there's certain pieces in tradition that sort of got rise to the level of being canonical in that way. There aren't very many of them. You know, but, you know, Confrontation obviously has been published by itself. It's a standalone text. That's one of those articles that you do read in classes on Jewish philosophy or contemporary Jewish culture, et cetera. And it's very widely cited, as opposed maybe to, you know, 95% of the other articles in tradition that are interesting at the moment, and they sort of fade away.
Right. Should also point out here, is with that digression there, there are a couple of themed issues of tradition. There happens to be one just on Rav Soloveitchik stuff, by which I mean, and here I have to distinguish between the modern tradition, most of the thing, like pretty much the entire edition or journal was essays by Rav Soloveitchik. Today, it's the rarity that you find an issue of tradition where someone isn't talking about something about Rav Soloveitchik. And here there's one volume. I forget which one offhand. Actually, I have it written down here. It's volume 17, number 2. It's where you have the essays, The Community, Majesty, and Humility, Catharsis, and Redemption, Prayer, and Talmud Torah, all in one special issue that they actually promoted on the archive site. Whereas today you have a lot of meta scholarship about, oh, here's what I think about what, you know, Rav Soloveitchik said. You could also just spend your time reading what Rav Soloveitchik actually said.
No, absolutely. Okay, I guess it's my turn now. What I'm going to talk about is, it's a very short one, but I think it's very telling. There are a few places in tradition over the last, I guess, 60 years or so where there's conversations that go back and forth. So, for example, even the article that I just cited about the Vietnam War had a response in the next issue, which took issue with a lot of the author's assumptions and his logical jump.
Hello? All right. Sorry about that. I'm going to have to do some editing there to bring back the I don't know, to sync it all up. So would you mind repeating that? Sorry about the technical difficulties. The title in the year.
Okay. The title is A Rabbinic Exchange on Baruch Goldstein's Funeral. It's from volume 28, number 4, summer 1994. And it's a translation of an exchange that took place in Israel in the journal Meimad, actually in the first issue of the journal Meimad. It was a discussion between the heads of three yeshivot relating to Baruch Goldstein's funeral. It began with a letter written by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the Rosh Kollel of Yeshiva University's Gros Kollel, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hesder Yeshiva, Yeshivat Har Etzion, in the Gush, which is only about a half-hour drive away from Hebron.
And back, that was before they pulled out. I got confused there between Beit Lechem. Sorry, continue. Mine went elsewhere. Go ahead, sorry.
Well, this is 1994, so this is actually after the Oslo Agreement, but it's before the Y Agreement.
Right.
So, let's say Israeli control over, you know, large parts of the West Bank was more extensive when he wrote this than it was a few years afterwards.
Sure.
Hang on just a second. Okay, I'm back.
All right, thank you.
Okay. So I guess we'll make an edit point.
Yeah.
The discussion is between Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the head of Yeshiva University's Grus Kollel in Bayit Vegan, but also the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion in Gush Etzion, only about a half-hour drive away from Hebron, where the massacre happened. And he's writing in the journal Meimad, translated for tradition, and he's writing about the way that the funeral of Baruch Goldstein happened. Baruch Goldstein, of course, was the person living in Kiryat Arba or Hebron who walked into Ma'arat HaMachpelah, the cave of the patriarchs, during the Muslim prayer service, and gunned down 29 people before he was killed by the crowd that was there. Aaron Lichtenstein is responding to protests against the fact that he had a traditional Jewish funeral and was eulogized kahalacha. He writes, with full ceremonial honor. He writes, during these troubled times, I feel compelled to temporarily abandon his tradition of not critiquing other yeshivot hesder, not out of a desire to express my opinion, but simply because it is impossible from a personal and moral stance to remain silent. So he writes, a person, whatever his previous merits may have been, departed this world while engaged in an act of awful and terrible slaughter, teva ayom v'nora, and thereby beyond the crime itself, desecrated the name of heaven, trampled upon the honor of the Torah and mitzvot, soiled and sullied the image of Knesset Yisrael, and endangered the future of Jewish settlement in Yehuda, Shomron, and Gaza. Hmm. The man won praise and honor in the yeshiva of his hometown in Kiryat Arba, and was eulogized kahalacha with full ceremonial honor by Hirosh Yeshiva. Woe to the ears that hear this.
Yeah, he's not one who pulls punches.
He's not one who pulls punches, and he's not one that punches very often.
Yeah.
And the letters that follow are letters written by the Rosh Yeshiva of Karnei Shomron, also relatively close geographically to the area. And it's a very simple letter, which doesn't say very much. It says, actually accuses Rav Aaron Lichtenstein of supporting the terrorists. He writes, as is well known, your honor supports the political process and all that accompanies it, meaning the Oslo Agreement, which includes, if even only de facto, the legitimization in the eyes of the entire world of the arch terrorist who has spilled the blood of Jews and others like water and the terrorist ideology he represents, thereby causing a terrible and awful desecration of God's name, a chilul Hashem nora v'ayom, to use Rav Aaron's language back at him, and indescribable damage to the Jewish people everywhere. That was the letter written by somebody else who wasn't involved. And then there's another letter from Rav Dov Lior, who is the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Nir in Kiryat Arba, who is the one who gave the eulogy, who explains why the eulogy was in the yeshiva. He says it was a technicality. He writes about, he says it was raining outside, we had to do it inside. He talks about the fact that Baruch Goldstein was an exemplary moral character up until that particular act. He says, he writes something else which I found very interesting. It's interesting if you flip it the other way, actually, especially in light of modern politics. He writes, indeed, I eulogize the late Baruch Goldstein, may Hashem avenge his blood, who was lynched by the non-Jews in the cave of Machpelah. A Jew who is killed because he is a Jew must certainly be called Kadosh, a holy martyr, just as we refer to the Kadosh HaShoah, the holy martyrs of the Holocaust, without investigating their previous conduct.
Mm.
How much more so in this case, for we knew him intimately as God-fearing and compassionate, as one who loved humanity and saved lives. So in other words, what he was saying is that just like we don't ask about somebody who was killed in Auschwitz, whether he was a good person or a bad person, up until the moment of his death,
yeah.
We treat him like a person. So similarly, Baruch Goldstein, who was killed for being Jewish, is not judged for anything that he did up until that point, even if what he did up until that point was kill 29 people, which was the immediate cause of that death.
Right. But he was really killed because he was Jewish, not because he gunned down people. It reminds me, I use this analogy a lot. You could appreciate this, too, in New York. If someone shoots up a liquor store, the mom always says, oh, he was a good kid. Yeah, he was a good kid who shot up a liquor store. Oh,
right,
wow.
Exactly.
That's...
It's amazing. It's an amazing thing. And the tone that these letters take back and forth, and Rav Aaron responds in a very forceful, though with a very toned and dignified language afterwards. But it's interesting because it's not the only time that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein gets into one of these debates in Israel with other members of the religious Zionist factions that found their way into the pages of tradition. In 2007, there was a remarkable exchange that he had with Avraham Shapira, who is one of the leaders of the religious Zionist movement, having to do with the pullout from Gaza. Avraham Shapira famously had called upon Israeli religious soldiers to disobey orders. He said it was completely against Jewish law to obey orders to remove Jews from their homes in the land of Israel. He said that it puts Jews in danger and it's forbidden in every sort of way. And Rav Aaron writes a series of letters to him, a series of questions to him on particular points that he brought up in the article. And Rav Shapira's grandson responds, and there's a back and forth which goes on for two issues, pages and pages and pages of it's very, very emotionally wrought because this is just after the pullback from Gaza, which was a very trying time for everyone in the religious camp, but was based purely in halachic sources. They were bringing proofs back and forth. They were debating technicalities as well as the larger issues. But it was a halachic discussion that was going back and forth, even though what was going on underneath it must have been an ideological battle as well. Sure. Here you just see the bitterness going back and forth. It's striking to see both of them in context.
Right. That's ooh, yeah. And you are right about Rav Aaron not punching very often. But whew. You'll also notice even when he does fight, hard. Did you notice him going ad hominem at all?
No, he never goes ad hominem. He actually writes. He writes, even as we are astonished by the silence relating to the tribute expressed in tears and eulogies, we must likewise question the inaction within our own yeshivot with regard to the killing itself.
Right.
So even as he's critiquing them for giving the eulogy, he's critiquing the larger movement as well for not forcefully protesting loud enough. He's saying it's not just you, but what you do is sort of showing that what we're doing is wrong as well.
Right.
So he's using a moment of introspection.
Oh, fascinating. My next was actually also on Israeli politics. This goes back to hitting rewind. This goes back to spring of 1969, volume 10, issue 3. The title is The Spiritual and Religious Meaning of Victory and Might by Yeshayahu Leibowitz. Now, a few reasons why this is fascinating is that back in the day, tradition published articles from people you might or you might not consider Orthodox, sometimes people who wouldn't themselves be considered Orthodox. There was an article by Rav David Weiss Alivni, and also a rejoinder to that. I came across an article by Ata Kasher. I don't know if people know him. He's also a major left-winger here. And also, oddly enough, the son of Rav Menachem Mendel Kasher, who wrote the Torah Shelema. I happen to have some family connection. That's the only reason why I know that. And Yeshayahu Leibowitz, these weren't things, incidentally, that were written, or at least I shouldn't say that. Sometimes tradition will publish translations of other Hebrew pieces. So this wasn't written specifically for tradition as much as, but it was still translated and included. And in this article, it's, part of a discussion, and there are a few things tradition really took on the state of Israel. There was another special volume, volume 2, number 2 from spring 1960, I think the one that you referenced, called Religious and State in Israel. So most of the things that were actually thematically based along those lines. These questions do come up. And what Yeshayahu Leibowitz is trying to address here is, is the very fact that we now, we won the Six-Day War, what does that mean for us religiously? And he's actually, if you know him, know his writings, it's not too surprising. But he gives somewhat of a firm reason not to put the Six-Day War in a religious context. Read one passage here. Some try to give religious significance to the war by means of halachic expression. Since we have been commanded to capture the land, the soldiers who did so fulfilled the religious imperatives, though they themselves have shed the yoke of Torah and mitzvot. In opposition to this, let it be said most forcefully that the selective use of halachic categories for those events that please us in the framework of a state and society that do not recognize the authority of halacha is a perversion and falsification of the religion. It betrays in no small measure a hypocritical stance. The main problem of halachic Judaism today is not that one is not able to make use of the traditional halachic categories with regard to a reality that halacha never dreamt possible, the reality of a greater part of the Jewish people abandoning the Torah. One cannot properly combine the commandment of conquering Israel together with a disbelief and desecration of the Sabbath and present all this as the realization of Torah. And there's a lot to unpack here, but you know, it's very easy when you get to like religion in Israel to oversimplify things in grand theories. And he's pointing out, like, yeah, it doesn't actually work that way, or when you do it, you're actually, you know, wreaking a lot more violence to the religion that you're trying to bring in other side, other stuff. Or, and, you know, you've got plenty of examples of things like that today where people overstate religious cases to the point where people aren't in one sense where, you know, it's not relevant or it doesn't resonate with people. And he's saying, it's actually something a little bit more here. Like, yes, you're trying to be from, but in doing so, you're in fact changing what halacha is really supposed to be. And the very fact that tradition would even publish this, granted, it was part of a journal where they had abstract here, says, because of intense and sustained interest in the numerous ramifications of the problem, meaning a religious meeting after the Six-Day War, they present the views of two prominent Israeli thinkers. I don't have in front of me who else was in there. But that they would even almost say, well, here's equal time. And we're giving you equal time because, you know, this is a good topic. I'm not sure if you would really see that today, or if the range of opinions would be a lot narrower than what they would have published back in the day. But anyway,
no, absolutely, yeah. No, I agree with you. And there's, I think, a lot of other examples of that in tradition as well. If you go back to one of the earlier issues that I quoted before, the issue that had the Victor Geller article I referenced at the beginning of this discussion. There's actually an interesting back and forth between Yeshayahu Leibowitz, again, and Yisrael Gantzvi, who was at the time the Secretary General of the Mizrahi movement, Mizrahi HaPoel, talking about separation of church and state in the state of Israel, which is a classic discussion about the about church and state. Yeshayahu Leibowitz felt that whether it's church and state or shul and state should be completely separated in Israel, that the religious authorities should have no standing in terms of whether stores are closed on Shabbat, whether two people are considered to be married or not in terms of the question of who is a Jew. And he said that entangling religious personal status questions with legal personal status questions could only lead to problems down the road that are detrimental both to religion and to politics. And Yisrael Gantzvi from Mizrahi said, but you know, there's no other way to do it because it's going to be too complicated to separate them. And he said, if we do separate them, it'll turn out that most people in the state of Israel are violating the laws of the Torah every single day in a way sanctioned by the government of the state of Israel, and that's impossible.
Yeah.
And they go back and forth deciding, trying to figure out which situation is worse, whether it's worse to have them separated or worse to have them together. But the arguments that they're making back and forth are the exact same arguments that are still being made today, even as civil marriage gets a little bit closer to reality in Israel.
And conversion problems.
And as the conversion problem continues to unwind, it goes back to 1960. And again, Yehiel Leibowitz is not necessarily somebody who would necessarily come up. And my theory about this is that, again, given what you were saying before, about the lack of outlets for this sort of information, you know, previously, before blogs, before lots of other publishing outlets, the editors of tradition sort of saw their role as giving the educated Jewish audience, and again, this is the house organ of the RCA, of the Rabbinical Council of America, it was giving their rabbis in the field and giving their intellectually inclined laity sort of a who's who. I mean, this is what's important to know about what's going on in the world today. This is what the important people are thinking about. So even if, you know, even if it's not coming from an Orthodox source per se or coming from within the mainstream of Orthodox thought, if it was important enough to be out there, important enough to be part of the conversations, it would usually find its way into tradition. probably, I think that's less true nowadays, probably because there's other places for that material to come. Mm-hmm. And generally people assume that people read things from more places nowadays.
Yeah, I think, absolutely.
You know, another article that I was looking at in this same vein, actually, is from Volume 6, Issue 2, so it's 1964, and it's written by Emanuel Rachman, one of the great giants of modern orthodoxy, who has sort of been out of the history of modern orthodoxy. But at the time, and if you go back through the tables of contents of tradition in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s into the early 80s, he's an intellectual force to be reckoned with. Mm-hmm. And you know, very clearly, he's one of those people whose articles were canonical in the day, even if maybe not so much nowadays.
Right.
And it's a book review that he wrote of what was also at the time a massively important book called Principia Talmudica. Mm-hmm. This is the Way of the Talmud, which was written by then Israel's chief justice, Professor Moshe Silberg, who was a Confederation rabbi. But went on to become Israel's chief justice. At the time, he also taught legal theory in Bar-Ilan University, was an internationally renowned legal scholar. And in this book, The Way of the Talmud, he calls for a certain revitalization of Mishpat Ivri. He called for people from across the Israeli spectrum to get together and based on Jewish precedent and based on Jewish sources to revitalize Jewish law for the modern era. Mm. And Rabbi Rachman, in this he talks about various aspects of that. He discussed, this is one of the sources for the great dialectic that we all know about, how Western law is based on rights and Jewish law is based on responsibility. So Rabbi Rachman is one of the earlier people in modern Orthodox discourse to make that point. He makes it in this piece in the early 1960s.
I believe it's called The Future of Law. Is that the article, The Future of Law?
The Future of Jewish Law.
The Future of Jewish Law.
Right. And He basically says he's not sure what the future of Jewish law is, but he agrees that there should be a future of Jewish law. That's the basic point of the review. He says that he calls for the creation of a special journal, which would be dedicated to Mishpat Ivri in America and in Israel, that would be comprised of people coming from the religious camps, from the legal camps. He actually mentioned, he said that such a journal was already projected by an editor of tradition a few years ago, or by Joseph B. Soloveitchik, also proposed that a series of such studies would be taken jointly by the RCA and Yeshiva University.
Wow.
So if you imagine, like, you know, YU and, you know, let's say Cardozo opening up a center for the study of Jewish and Western law, you know, the Rav was calling for that back in the 1960s, apparently, although it never seemed to happen.
And it shocks me to no end why they haven't done it. Like, you'd think, like, maybe Dayanim, like, Yad and Yadim program, you got a law school, maybe do something together. Oh, wow.
It's an interesting thing. And what's striking to me also is that he goes back and forth. He discusses whether it's better to have a law which is up to date and current and takes modern conditions into account, or whether it's better to have law which is, you know, let's say which was at one point authentically Jewish, even if that Jewish law was developed in a context, let's say, you know, that went back to the Byzantine era, or went back to the early medieval period, not necessarily relevant in that context to modern life. And he goes back and forth about that a little bit as well.
Cool. Yeah, I did come across that article.
If an Israeli Supreme Court justice or an Israeli chief justice writes a book about Mishpat Ivri, there would be somebody on the American scene who would tell the American audience, by the way, this book came out, this is important, and this should be part of the things that we're thinking about. I think that was one of the points of tradition back then.
Sure. You had book reviews. You know, you mentioned one, but those appeared a lot. And you also had almost like a column called Current Jewish Periodicals. I believe there was someone named Jacobowitz, I could be getting the name wrong, who did it for a bunch of years. J.D. Bleich has done it now.
That was Rabbi Lord Emanuel Jacobowitz.
Was it him? I wasn't sure about that. It was Rabbi Lord Emanuel Jacobowitz did a Current Jewish Periodicals, basically a column, like a review column of articles there. So he did that. Rabbi J.D. Bleich does it now. My father did that for a while in, I think, late 80s, early 90s, around that. I know he would say not only did he enjoy it, but he further enjoyed getting free stuff. And I know people would say it's like you know, why do you spend so much time writing all these reviews? My dad's like, I get free books. So you do find a lot of interesting things there. And I think going back to the, I don't know how much of it's true today anymore in terms of, looking to tradition to seeing what else is out there. But here, you know, there was a certain time. It's like, yeah, by the way, people are writing this stuff and it's kind of important. Very cool. My next one is from 1992. So, I think that's right. Yeah. Skipping, let me just make sure that I got the dates right. No, I'm sorry. Next one I have, I thought I skipped something. So we're skipping a bit of the '70s, going to, 1987, Rav Moshe Tendler, The Anatomy of a Responsum, The Kashrut of Vinegar Produced from Wine Alcohol. This is volume 22-4, winter of 1987. And the reason why I like this particular tshuva, it's not, you know, you can say, you know, we can argue how big Rav Moshe Tendler was about a big person, but it's very Rav Tendler-esque. I happen to have studied with him for 2.5 years at YU, still in contact with him. And to explain a bit about the context here, this was in this time, there was a huge argument over stam vinegar for kashrut purposes in terms of being used for ketchup and mustard and condiments. So that's all. That's the discussion. Rav Tendler had an argument with another YU Rosh Yeshiva. I won't mention his name now. But here's how Rav Tendler begins his article. Quotes a pasuk in Mishlei, Proverbs 10:26, as vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is the laggard that sent him. In this imagery, King Solomon suggests that failure to fulfill responsibilities with vigor and intelligence leads to confusion and frustration. The torch that was to dispel the darkness often produces a smoky flame that smarts the eyes and blurs the vision. The vinegar intended as an appetite stimulant sometimes suppresses the appetite when it dulls the teeth. The recent finding that vinegar produced from alcohol distilled from wine has mistakenly been used to produce kosher food products caused much consternation within the Torah community. Much of this dismay resulted from the failure to properly apply the halachic process to elucidate the problem. So he's starting out right now with a dig at his opposition, quoting a pasuk in Mishlei, trashes them for not knowing what they're doing, has chemical equations in tradition where he writes, well, here's actually how, you know, it gets made, which just blew me away. And also as an aside, when I read through it carefully, his conclusion is that it's fine b'diavad, it's fine after the fact. And I went up to him once. I said, you know, Rebbe, I just learned this. I just read this article of yours, but I don't understand it. You concluded that it's mutter b'diavad, but according to your argument, why isn't this mutter l'chatchila? And he told me, you're right. I couldn't get away with saying more at the time. So you can take that as you wish in terms of the, you know, apocryphal stuff, but I just found it to be just a fascinating, I mean, at the time I found it when I was actually in Rav Tendler's shir. So Rina's like, hey, you know, let me just read up everything I have from it. I just thought that this encapsulated his personality so much in terms of tone and content. And still, he also throws in at the end, to declare as non-kosher food products containing vinegar mistakenly produced from wine/mark alcohol such as mayonnaise, ketchup, mustard, perverts the halachic process and is in violation of the halachot prohibiting both wastefulness, bal tashchit, and causing economic loss to fellow Jews. Just, I don't know, for me it's just remarkable, but for more personal reasons than anything earth-shattering.
No, I hear that. It's always fun to find these little anecdotes sort of back and forth through these things as the conversations go on.
And when you know the people, you know all of these side references. Like when he's throwing in this diss, you know, like comparing it to, you know, quoting this pasuk in Mishlei, and you know the person who he's talking about, even though he doesn't mention it explicitly, can give you a nice other dimension to things. So anyway.
Right. No, for sure, 100%. My next article, I think this is my last one, comes from winter 1965. So it's, volume 7. It's, number 7-4. And it is written by Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, who was at the time the book editor of Tradition and the rabbi of Congregation Beth Jacob in Atlanta, Georgia. Again, one of the towering figures of modern Orthodoxy, and I'd say maybe two generations ago, in terms of really going out, building communities out of the New York metro area, where none really had existed before on that level. And the article is entitled Changing Patterns in Biblical Criticism, Their Implications for the Traditional Jew. And this struck me on several levels. I just did a quick search, as we were just talking, on the word, looking for the word criticism in titles of tradition articles going back to 1959 or so. And I found maybe five hits.
Yeah.
The word criticism is not a word which pops up very much, whether in terms of, you know, textual criticism or, you know, like a feminist critique, or that word seems not to pop up at all. It's not part of the discourse. And there were no I haven't seen any articles written about biblical criticism per se in tradition since the late 1960s.
Oh, since the 1960s.
Since the late 1960s.
Yeah. Okay.
Imagine there was a period, let's say, in the 50s, maybe the 60s, into the early 70s, when tradition or when modern Orthodoxy intelligentsia were concerned with the challenges posed by biblical criticism, when obviously their congregations were asking them questions about this, and they felt it was important to discuss it in light of, you know, recent discoveries and figure out what was going on. And there was some sort of I'm not sure if it was necessarily a defensive posture, but it was certainly part of the discussion. Mm. At a certain point, the if you just looking at the titles of tradition articles as a metric, that sort of drops out of the discussion entirely. Emmanuel Feldman, for example, you know, as a traditional pulpit rabbi, is a strange person to be writing. I think is a strange person to be writing an article about this in the first place. And most rabbis that I know who have congregations don't spend too much time talking about biblical criticism with their congregations. It's not part of the discourse.
Right.
We're talking about religious meaning. You know, we're talking about, you know, maybe trying to get some sort of message out of Midrash or figure out the workings of how rabbinic exegesis works. The idea of biblical criticism, they just sort of say, you know, we're not even going to deal with that. Just take it, you know, as a given, basically. Let's work internally with our own discourse and leave that all on the outside. But apparently there was a time when this sort of became an issue. I even noticed looking through the tables of contents when the first Dead Sea Scrolls were published in the late 50s, early 60s. There's a lot of tradition articles about them. Written also by contemporary scholars who were biblical scholars, trying to figure out what the scrolls meant, what their implications were for the Orthodox community. Mm-hmm. You know, nowadays, if you ask somebody, you know, what do the Dead Sea Scrolls mean to the Orthodox Jewish community? You know, the answer would be nothing.
Right.
But, you know, apparently back then, like, those were questions that they had to deal with. So Emmanuel Feldman deals a little bit with recent archaeological discoveries that corroborate some parts, some strata of the Bible. He writes about the beginning of the downfall of the very strict documentary hypothesis,
mm-hmm.
when styles are beginning to move away from, you know, the text being sort of explicit, very rigidly divided between various hypothesized biblical authors. And when people were, you know, people were beginning to embark on study that was more gradual, or it was less certain than it was before. And Feldman uses this as a defense of faith, basically. He writes, for providing us with such positive support of the Bible, archaeology is greatly to be praised. But there's one caveat. Archaeology is not the handmaiden of the Bible. It's not invariably a support to the Torah. He says, similarly, apparent contradictions to Torah do not disturb him. He remembers only too well that just 40 years ago, Torah had been, quote, scientifically disproved, only to find the disprover itself became the disproved.
Mm.
So he's showing that as the field of biblical archaeology, as the field of Bible criticism begins to develop, we shouldn't ever see any particular school as a checkmate against the traditional beliefs in terms of the origin of the Torah and Jewish history, because eventually the field will develop a little bit past that. And basically, you know, as long as we don't know anything with 100% certainty, there's no reason not to take our timeline versus theirs.
Right. I think that's – thank you for bringing that in. When I was going through the archives too, I also saw a bunch of things on biblical criticism. I shared some quotes on Facebook. You're absolutely right that this isn't even discussed anymore because it's turned far too polemical. But if you read some of the articles, there was him and some of the others from the 60s, the arguments that were being made today would still make you a kofar. Meaning if you made the arguments that people were making back in the 60s today, people say, ah, you're still a Kofer because you're not believing B'Emunah Shleimah in exactly the same way that I want you to.
Or you're engaging in the discussion, basically.
Right, or even just, you're wrong. But even when you're saying, well, here's a solution that I have, or here's an approach, here are some assumptions I'm making, even that in this context, in the context of biblical criticism today, will get you labeled a heretic. And I know this because I've seen it, you know, thrown out at people.
It's very striking, especially there's certain, some of the articles that, you know, let's say that you probably saw that I was looking through the contents were written by the Jacob Baumgartens of the world, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. people who taught biblical studies at Yeshiva University or in other institutions. This article is written by Emanuel Feldman, who was the rabbi of a shul in Atlanta.
Right.
Very far from the center of, you know, biblical criticism, where that wasn't really what he was doing professionally. But he still felt that, you know, he was up on recent developments in the field. He was sort of aware of what was going on to a certain degree. And he felt the need to provide an orthodox response, or at least an orthodox commentary on what was happening in the field. I think that's what's missing nowadays.
So I'll even throw in something else here. The rabbis back in the day, Professor Arthur Hertzberg wrote about this, you know, were a lot, I would say, much had a much, at a great degree of higher education, and this used to be the role of the Rav. You had a lot of people who came to shul who didn't have much of a Jewish education. They expected a high level of intellectualism from the rabbi. Many pulpit rabbis back in the day had PhDs or DHLs, a doctorate of Hebrew letters, sort of like a professional doctorate. And you had an audience that wanted a knowledgeable, scholarly rabbi who could speak intelligently on such things. You might not find that so much today anymore, simply because the needs of the communities are so different. And in some cases, being too much of an intellectual will be seen as a liability. You know, so even the fact that a pulpit rabbi, so I wonder if you could say, like, you know, it's rare for a pulpit rabbi to do that. I'd say back when he wrote it, it might not have been such a rarity. Today, you're not going to find a pulpit, well, I shouldn't say that. The anomaly are the pulpit rabbis who engage in such things and who can also still keep their job. But back in the day, it was completely different.
Right. The rabbis who, you know, those rabbis who do or are aware of these things and who do write about these things don't publish their findings in tradition.
Right.
That's more the point.
They would be actual academics and they would write in academic journals. And you could also say that this might even represent, I don't want to say the decline of intellectualism, but the shift of intellectualism among the pulpit rabbis, where, you know, back then you could actually have this on a regular basis. Today, the only people who really do it are the actual academics, and, you know, you're just not reading the same stuff anymore.
I agree. Yeah, another interesting trend I sort of picked up on, just, you know, speaking more generally, which I think speaks to the same larger trends, are if you look back through the earlier decades of tradition, you don't see too many pieces that involve real halachic discourse, mm-hmm. trying to figure out the halachic response to Y and Z. They're more philosophical pieces, they're community-based pieces, they're public policy pieces. As you start moving into the later decades, you start seeing more halachic pieces. So you'll see, mm-hmm. for example, the Rabbi Schreimer writing about, you know, women's tefillah groups.
Yeah, they
very
do some
long
wonderful
article, hundreds of footnotes.
Yeah, hundreds of footnotes. Their work is halachic. Yeah, it is halachic. I'm just, you know, going to plug them here. Whether or not you happen to agree again with any of their conclusions, their research, I mean, the footnotes alone, just what they put into it.
It's impressive. You look at the articles that Rabbi Michael Broyd has written. The articles about Havi Naini, which became a book, the article about women's hair covering, which was very famous, etc.
The exchange between Rabbi Weider and Rabbi Riskin over Hafgat Kedushin. That was even in the same issue.
Right. And those kinds of issues, which are halachic issues, I don't think were discussed in tradition as much earlier, but that could be a sign, again, of sort of a shifting focus in the Orthodox rabbinate. This is what the rabbis are discussing now. Maybe even this is what the congregations want to be reading about to a certain degree.
Sure.
Or, you know, this is what the educated lady wants to be reading. Previously, the educated lady wanted to hear interesting things about, you know, space travel and halacha. Nowadays, they want a think piece with hundreds of footnotes, or a very detailed article with hundreds of footnotes about women's hair covering.
Well, because the implications are also so different in terms of how PSOC works. You know, so like there's like, yeah, well, here are just some opinions about it, but it was never intended as I'm the last word. Now part of the rhetoric is, you know, this is it. You don't need anything else. But then I'm going to need to back that up a lot more. You know, I think on extraterrestrials, yeah, you know, that can be a fun conversation. But like if I'm going to say this is the halacha on women's, you know, head covering, yeah, I'm going to need to come correct for that one.
Right. And I think that sort of shows you a different focus. Yeah, I'm not sure who's writing the teshuvot, let's say, for the modern Orthodox Jewish community in the 50s and 60s and 70s,
right.
Or what language the teshuvot, you know, the teshuvot were written in or where they were published per se. But to a certain degree, those teshuvot are really being written in the pages of tradition and in journals like this, not as, you know, not as traditional teshuvot in rabbinic dialogue, in rabbinic right. text. In that sort of language, but they're written as academic style articles in a peer-reviewed journal.
Right. So my last one is actually also a Ravarn Lichtenstein one. It's from Tradition 26-4, 1992. You might find this one interesting. The Israeli Chief Rabbinate, A Current Halachic Perspective. And like Ravaro, and I mean, it shouldn't say like Ravaro, this comes up a lot in Brisk, he doesn't actually reach a conclusion. He basically looks at it from both sides, and at the end he says, well, don't over-exaggerate it, and don't under-exaggerate the significance either. But it's a fascinating look at rabbinic authority, which is a theme that does come up a lot in tradition, at least certainly in the later years, although there are earlier ones on, like, what is Amar Da'atra and the like. And there was one quote that really stuck out for me here, where he says, no solid base for the mandatory establishment of such a body exists. Not only does halacha fail to provide such a course at a national level, but to the best of my knowledge, it does not even require it at the local level. We are very much attuned to the concept of Mora Da'atra, a single rabbinic figure or group endowed by a specific community with spiritual hegemony. And indeed, this model was prevalent in much of the diaspora and historically served the Knesset well. However, the halachic status of the Mora Da'atra related to his position in the wake of his selection. Nothing militated the creation of the post ab initio. Which I joked, you know, I said something similar like that about the role of the Rav, and I get blasted for it. And this is Ravaron, you know, saying pretty much the same thing about the Mora Da'atra is picked by the community. And it's fascinating to read this. Jeffrey Wolf also has an interesting article on precedent. And when you see, like, these concepts of halacha that are portrayed in the articles of tradition back then, and even this isn't back then. I mean, this is, you know, mid-90s. Jeffrey Wolf's piece, forget if that was in the late 80s, early 90s, but around this time, he said it was the first thing that he actually built. What?
But right, it's only 15 years ago.
Right, only 15 years ago. But you compare back then, people were actually discussing, like, halachic authority. We're discussing things like that. I'm not sure if people really took the implications and ran with it as much as, you know, today you'll see, like, it's all about polemic. And I think there's a reason for that. Something that you find in Mark Shapiro's wonderful book on Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox, that, you know, conservative Judaism was tolerated begrudgingly up until the point they started doing their own psak halacha. So, you know, you can see all these things written, but once you start taking these ideas to a different place, that's when people say, oh, like, yeah, we didn't really mean you should apply it the way you wanted it to. And then, you know, things start breaking down.
You can't do that.
Right. You're not allowed, like, these are the laws, but you're not allowed to actually do that. Once people actually started, like, realizing, it's like, hey, yeah, well, why can't this work? And then things just start, like, completely, you know, breaking down. Yeah. So, wow, we spent a lot of time with this. And there's just so many more other good stuff. We didn't talk about Chaim Soloveitchik's Rupture and Reconstruction, which, if you're familiar with the world, is an absolute must-read. Again, not if you agree with it, but just in terms of, you know, literacy of an important piece. A few others come to mind. Rachel Levmore wrote a great one on variants and halachic prenups and the history thereof. For those who are familiar with Chacham Fa'ur, he has a piece in there on covenant. You know, I'm not sure if you can find it elsewhere there, but there are so many gems, you know, throughout. I mean, think about it. You've got, you know, decades of material. Something's got to be good. And I would suggest, and as Avra mentioned, on their website, and we'll have links to everything, there's an Excel file with every article in every order from tradition. So you don't even need to search Rambi to look for stuff. And you can find people you like. You can find articles you like. If you're interested in economics and Judaism, Aaron Levine has, you know, dozens some odd articles here, you know, that deal with these things. And you can just go to town, and there's just – there is some, even if, again, if you don't like the content, just it can help get you thinking. And the footnotes are also spectacular, because if you're just interested in a starting point, you know, someone else did the work for you. And this can really, you know, help open up. I really wish, I mean, reading this gets me, you know, feeling a little bit nostalgic about what things were. I hope people will actually read through this stuff and it'll certainly take it seriously. And I don't know, maybe if it can renew interest, it can actually, you know, we'll see if it helps either bring tradition back to what it used to be, or a reasonable alternative. Because there were a bunch of things like this that did come around. Do you remember Gesher?
I remember Gesher.
Yeah.
And so, we still have Chakira.
Right. And you have Chakira now, which, you know, certainly filled in one niche of it. But I would also, you know, independent of content in this case, I think it behooves people to read, this is how Orthodox Jews used to speak to each other.
Well, this is, I'm not sure how representative this is. I mean, this is how a certain elite of the modern Orthodox Jewish rabbinate used to speak to each other.
True, but it's still a lot better than what you find today. Amongst people in the exact same positions, meaning the same pulpit jobs, the same positions at, you know, Rosh Yeshiva, like YU, with possible exceptions for Varon Lichtenstein, because, I mean, thank God he's still alive and, you know, he's still going to be who he is. But, you know, the Jewish intellectual leadership used to write this way, used to talk this way. Like I mentioned with Rabbi Lam, actually felt that there was a need to justify their positions respectfully. And you look at today, you don't see that. And I don't know if it's, I mean, listen, even when I write on my own website, people complain my stuff is too long, right? TLDR, you know, why should I bother with that? And back in the day, people, you know, this was how things were done. And the expectation was, you know, from the layperson's perspective, if you want to be part of the conversation, someone else, you know, can get you there part of the way, but you need to actually put in some effort and thought. Yeah, Ech Naflu Agiborim, or Oy Mehayalano, whichever one you want to take.
I think it's part of a general trend, though. I mean, nowadays, let's say these pieces would be summarized on blogs where they'd be discussed by people, you know, pulling out three or four sentence snippets, and it would be basically the same sort of thing. So I don't think that it's anything which is unique to the Orthodox Jewish community. I think it's more of a general trend in who's reading what or what people have attention for.
Oh, absolutely. I just would like to add, there's like, yeah, I don't think this is just for Orthodox Judaism. I would just say for those who are, you think that there's something in like systemic to Orthodox Judaism or endemic to Orthodox Judaism, better word there. There was a time where we could have normal, good discussions with people with whom we disagreed and do so in a high level, generally respectfully, or even when we, you know, did insult people. You know, there were certainly limits to how we did things, you know, like you could be really critical, but it's like, you know, so-and-so's a kofer and we need to write people out of Orthodoxy. Like, you didn't see that in tradition so much back in the day.
No, I hear that. I understand that. And the other thing that you really get out of this in the same vein is that a lot of the intellectual giants of the modern Orthodox community, and we still read them when they publish works now, the Rav Aaron Lichtensteins, the Rabbi Yitz Greenbergs, the Rabbi Mark Angels, the Rabbi Norman Lambs, they were really good writers.
Yes.
There was a certain poetry to their writing. There was a certain nobility to their writing. If you know, when you read any of these articles, the ones that we were discussing today, it really you really get the sense that you're reading something lofty, you're reading something noble. That's something which I think is also that's been degraded a little bit over time.
That is a wonderful point.
I think when I think about what I'm nostalgic about reading these articles, I think it's more of that sense.
Yeah, you see that rarely. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein had a piece a couple of years ago in Kol Isha that was at that level. Very few people can write that way. And even if it's not poetry, it's just good writing. It's coherent. It's clear. It's forceful. Again, without being insulting. And you lost that. The poets, the writing poets, you don't have so much anymore. You know, Heschel was spectacular with that. Anyway, Thank you very much for your time. This was, for me, a great deal of fun. I hope it was a great deal of fun for the people who listened. Everyone is recommended to look up all of these things. And I'd say just peruse the giant Excel file, see if something is interesting. It's up there. It's free. Just go and have fun. You want to plug anything while we're here? Something going on at the shul? Something going on personally or Torah Stone stuff? Or...
not
all right.
Our annual dinner is coming up December 10th, but you probably got the invite. And if you didn't, you're probably not going anyway.
Yeah, well, it's a far walk for me. Anyway, again, thank you so much for your time. This was a blast. And at the end of the day, if people can read more and think more, that's a win, however you count it. Be well.
I agree. Thank you.